You ever been, say, your birthday, and people give you gifts, and people try to think of things that maybe you could use or that you would like, and you appreciate the thought that goes into it. But has it ever happened, say, on a birthday like that, there's one special gift that maybe somebody thought of, and you can tell they put a lot of thought and work in it, and they know you, and they picked out what they know would be something you could really appreciate and use. You ever had a gift like that? Let me ask you a question. What indicates that the woman was that kind of gift from God? We talked about that in our last class. What in the text indicates she was that kind of gift? Turn to Genesis chapter 2. So Adam's condition, verse 18, is he is alone. And God says it is not good. So it's not being alone like somebody chooses to be alone, to go hunting or to go walking. It's a situation where there's something missing. And so God says, I will make a helper suitable for him. Then the next two or three verses talk about the animal kingdom, all brought before Adam. But at the end of verse 20, there's a little statement that the Holy Spirit wants us to focus on. Out of all that varied animal kingdom, there was not found a helper suitable for him, corresponding to the need that he had. And so God caused him to fall into a deep sleep, and he created a woman. And when he brought the woman to the man, what is it Adam said that indicates this is the gift of gifts? This is perfect. The perfect gift. Look at your text. Well, that is true, but there's a little word. Now, at last, this is the perfect gift. So God says, here, Adam. He brings her to the man. Of course, she's got a little tag attached with love from God. This is the perfect gift. So, what does that say about my responsibility as a man?
You
got to
take care of that fresh gift.
That's right. God's going to expect me to appreciate it, to treat that gift like I appreciate it. Not like some everyday old rag that I throw in the corner until I need it. And so it's incumbent on a man to realize that God made the woman special, built her, the text says, created her, to meet a need that no other being, including another man, could meet. He could have created another man, but he didn't. He created a woman and brought her to the man. Now, if God created, multiplied thousands of animals, which I guess he did in the beginning, and plants of all kinds, could he have created two women, or three women, or four women for Adam? He could have. But he created one woman, didn't he? So look at Matthew chapter 19. Matthew chapter 19. This is number 12 on your lesson, by the way. We'll come back to number 11 in just a moment. Look at number 12, Matthew 19. The Pharisees ask him, verse 3, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any cause at all? So Jesus, in his response, did what we should do when we are asked questions. He said, have you not read? Now, to be able to do that, this, what we're doing tonight, can help equip us. It won't do it all. It will not substitute for personal Bible study. But striving to get us acquainted with Scriptures that will help us meet life's questions. This is an important one. Can I divorce my wife? Jesus said, have you not read? And he went back to the very text that we were talking about, Genesis chapter 2. And it's interesting now, Jesus' statement. Have you not read that he who created them from the beginning? He didn't just say, join them together. He said, made them male and female. One male, one female. Not men and women. Male and female. Then the next statement, verse 5, for this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the what? Two shall become one flesh. So, when asked about marriage and God's plan for marriage, its continuity, Jesus goes back to the beginning. Here was God's plan. So the question comes up, what's wrong with having more than one wife if they're agreeable? If I've got the means to provide for them? Answer, have you not read? He made the male and the female and said two. Made one woman for one man. That's God's plan. Polygamy is not God's original plan. So we ask number 11. So who introduced polygamy? So Adam and Eve, of course, did not practice polygamy. You go back to Genesis chapter 4, and you have two branches of the human family being discussed here in chapter 4. You have Abel's branch, or Seth's branch, since Cain killed Abel, and then Seth became the one through whom the lineage came. And then you have Cain's branch of the family. Cain was not a man who respected God's will. He was a man of the world. And you're looking, verse 19, and Cain's branch is Lamech. He said he took to himself two wives. That's not what God intended. That's not how it started. Man deviated from God's plan. And when men deviate from God's plan, we're asking for trouble. And so it's not in Abel's branch, the man of faith, not in Seth's branch, the descendant of Abel, but in Cain's branch. The family, you also find in Cain's branch was the idea of revenge for somebody wounding him or hurting him. So we have here on number 11, polygamy was the cause of domestic discord. Go to Genesis 16. Some good people were involved in polygamy. Did not make it right. Was not God's plan. God tolerated it. Why he tolerated it, I cannot tell you. But he did. And here we have Abraham married to Sarah, but he has a woman by whom he bears children, Hagar. Whose idea was it for him to have this second woman?
Sarah.
Not God's. And so this is Sarah's plan. She wasn't satisfied. Had God told them that they would have a child? Yes. But time passed, no child. And sometimes when we don't understand God's calendar, we don't agree with it, or we don't like it, we want to devise our own plan. Sarah did, and it caused problems. So she suggested that he take Hagar as a concubine, which he did. But what's interesting here in this text, in Genesis chapter 16 and verse 4, he went into Hagar, and she conceived. And when she saw that she had conceived, her mistress was despised in her sight. I'm not sure what that entailed. I don't know if she said ugly things to her or about her. I don't know if Abraham began to show some kind of affection for Hagar, and she sarcastically chided Sarah for that. I don't know. I don't know if she, because she despised Sarah, she said hard and mean things to Sarah, and Abraham didn't intervene to correct that. I don't know exactly what the circumstances were. But she was despised in her sight. And so Sarah said, may the wrong done me be upon you. For some reason, Sarah felt Abraham was partially responsible for this. Again, I don't know if he showed affection, if it's failure to defend Sarah. I don't know what the reason was. But be that as it may, you can see there's discord there in this particular family. And so that was a result of a failure to follow God's plan. Well, you get over to chapter 21. And so I don't know when women dwell together in polygamous relationships. I can't imagine it not being a problem. That one woman is the favorite, for example. And how do the other women feel? Known to be the favorite, either by the way the man treats her, or the gifts he gives her, or whatever it may be. But over in chapter 21, the same couple, well, three, Sarah, Abraham, and then Hagar. You see there's a problem again. In chapter 21, and we're not going to read verse 8 through 21. So look at verse 9. Sarah saw the son of Hagar, the Egyptian, whom she had borne to Abraham, mocking. Now it's a problem between the two women's children. One's mocking the other. And so, I have no doubt it was a heartache to Abraham. But be that as it may, Abraham drove Hagar out and her son. How that must that have made Hagar feel and her son feel? But none of that would have happened if one woman for one man. Right? So, you see problems. Well, look at chapter 29. Here's another case. This time, two women in the household again, two wives. This is Jacob with Rachel and Leah. And so, he loved Rachel because she was pretty. Leah wasn't as pretty. Leah was probably the better woman, but be that as it may. So he married both women. Now, when you get down a little bit further in this chapter, you'll see verse 31, the Lord saw Leah was unloved. Not that Jacob didn't take care of her, not that he didn't have married relationship with her, but he didn't have the same feelings for her that he had for Rachel. And so as a result, there began to be contention between these two women. You read about it in chapter 29 and 30. And it arose because of a problem with one able to bear children and the other not. And if you're a Hebrew, that's very important. And so, problems in the family again. So, you get to 1 Samuel chapter 1. Look at 1 Samuel chapter 1. Here's another case. Elkanah had two wives. Verse 2, he had two wives. The name of the one was Hannah, the name of the other Peninnah. Once again, there's conflict. You see, in verse 6, one would provoke the other bitterly. And so Peninnah would provoke Hannah because Peninnah could have children, Hannah couldn't have any. You imagine what she said? Ridicule her, make her feel bad. But once again, here's a man with two wives. I don't know the case. Y'all may know one. Welcome to mention it if you do. Where a case in the Bible is recorded more than one wife, where there's peace and harmony. But we do see discord and trouble time after time after time. It's not God's plan. If there's some way it can be peace and harmony, does that make it okay? No. Why not? It's not God's plan. It's just that simple. That's right. Yes, sir.
All right, so I want to play devil's advocate here for a minute. If I gather all the information, woman was made for man, multiple marriages were allowed, nowhere is it condemned that polygamy is, so these verses you provided are just discord. So something God established can be perverted, can be misused, I think, about worship and other things. Is there any other verses you can go to point to that, you know, woman was made for man, more than woman for a man? I mean, I understand he made man and woman, he made Adam, he made Eve for Adam, but I mean, is there any other verse you could point to that was better? Because I can see somebody having this conversation. Well, you know, woman was made for man. God allowed it to happen. It just became something that was corrupt. But done the right way, where a man is diligent, loving. I'm just thinking of.
That's a good argument, Key. So God allowed it to happen, so maybe it's not so bad. And God allowed Cain to kill Abel. So he gave him the strength to do it, didn't he? So I guess if your brother gets the honor and you kill him, that's okay. And so God allowed wicked men to oppress righteous men. God allowed the Jews to divorce their wives with a certificate. Was that pleasing to God?
But I find authority in the Bible because I find not just one example, but multiple, many examples showing that polygamy was allowed.
It was allowed. God allowed things that were not authorized.
So how do you determine that this wasn't authorized?
Genesis chapter 2, 1 Corinthians chapter 7. I just did it in Genesis chapter 1. That's what Jesus did.
1 Corinthians 7 is what I was thinking about.
Not 1 Timothy, 1 Corinthians 7. But I can do just what Jesus did. Good question. How do I know God intended one woman for one man? How do I know I can't divorce my wife? How did Jesus answer that? We've been divorcing them for 1,500 years. God has allowed it. In fact, didn't they make that argument? In Genesis 9? I mean, Matthew 9, 19? Didn't they make that argument?
Yes.
Yes. But what did Jesus say?
From the beginning,
it was not so. So, you have the beginning.
But that's specific to divorce, isn't it? Again, from the beginning, it wasn't so.
But what did he quote? Was in the beginning. How many?
One and one.
Male and female. And how many did he say?
Two.
Two. That's the Lord, quoting Genesis, in answer to the question about marriage and splitting up a marriage. Okay, we won't have more than one wife at a time. We'll have multiple wives, but we'll do it at different times. We'll divorce this one and get number two. And we'll divorce this one and get number three. Is that okay? Where's the verse that says, thou shalt not have three wives? That's right. Look, it's a good question, but Jesus was asked a question, and he said, here it was in the beginning. Here's the answer to your question about whether you can have more than one wife. Get rid of this one, get another one. What if I want to have two at the same time? Where can I go? Same place. I'd go back to Genesis 2. That's God's plan from the beginning.
Can you not use
1 Corinthians 7 is good. But that was written to Christian, but it applied to everybody. Genesis 2 had nothing to do with Jews or Gentiles, Christians or not Christians, black or white, whatever language. It's universal. God made one woman for one man. The two, Jesus said, should be one flesh. Introduce another woman. Now what do you have? You got three? Four? Jesus said, the two shall be one flesh.
But the one flesh is just talking about a conjugal relationship. It's quoted in 1 Corinthians 6, 16.
So what's going to happen with the third woman? No conjugal relationship?
Not at the same time.
What do you mean not at the same time? Well, I mean, you mean they're not going to be conjugal relationship?
1 Corinthians 6, 16 says, do you not know that one who joins himself to a prostitute is one body with her? For he says the two shall become one flesh, for each is the two one body.
So what, man has a right to have a conjugal relationship with one woman, and that's his wife. Now, look at 1 Corinthians 7. I do not depend on 1 Corinthians 7. I think Genesis 2 answers the question. And then in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, in verse 2, each man is to have what? A wife? Well, which one is his own? He's got five. His own wife. This woman is his. She belongs to him. And what's the next about the woman?
Her own.
Now remember, husband, wife, the words are woman, man. Each woman is to have her own man. And each woman, man is to have his own woman. Which one is that? Is that wife two, wife three?
Couldn't you go to Romans 7, 1-3? Just talk about it being joined to another man is adultery.
It is, and I think that is in accord with this. Romans chapter 7, Dawn mentions that, which is good. If while her husband is living, verse 3, she's joined to another man, what does he call it?
Adultery.
But I don't have to go past Genesis chapter 2, in my thinking, at least. That's what Jesus did. You say, well, prove divorce is wrong. Well, I can go to Matthew 5. I go to 1 Corinthians 7. But Jesus went to Genesis 2. What bearing did Genesis 2 have on it? Unless Jesus was saying, this is God's plan. This is what God approves. Somebody else want to comment on it? Yes, sir. Ronnie?
Dodge the divorce question by comparing the second one without divorcing the first one. So basically, you invalidated Christ's whole point there. I mean, if you can marry two wives, why bother with a divorce?
Okay.
Just marry the second one and keep the first one out of the house and stay married to her, you know.
That's a good point. Why divorce the first one if you can say it's wrong? I'll just get number two.
Somehow or another, we've got something like that is lighter than divorce
marriage. Deuteronomy 17:17 was, the king shall not multiply wives, unless it turns hard away. And, you know,
that's a good point.
That's to the king. But that is the verse that directly mentions the concept of polygamy. It says don't do it. To the king, but it's not given to go ahead. It's given to don't do that.
Okay, good point about kings should not multiply wives, turn his heart away. Okay, yes, Alex?
A good example of what happened when you do that is King Solomon, he let his wife turn him away from the Lord.
Every case of polygamy, as far as I know, had problems. But if I didn't have that, Jesus didn't appeal to any of that when he was asked, can I divorce my wife? He went back to the beginning. Is the word divorce even mentioned in Genesis 2? So how is he arguing? If divorce is not even mentioned, Genesis 2. Did Genesis 2 say you can't divorce your wife? Does it? No. So what's Jesus' argument? It's right there in Matthew 19. From the beginning, it was not so. Look, you can use that same argument in so many areas. So what's wrong with instrumental music? It helps our singing. People like it. We'll get folks in. Would this be a good answer? From the beginning, it was not so. Is that a good answer or not? What beginning am I talking about now?
Beginning of the church.
That's right.
No evidence. That's right. This is an authority. This is how we approach the word. We know we're authorized to have a wife. We don't see clear evidence that we're authorized to have multiple wives. We see evidence of kings were not to have multiple wives. You're referencing these other passages about don't put her away, except for immorality. It's just we stay in this safe, respectful position of we'll do what God gave us authority to do and don't hear from that.
Good point. So you gathered all the facts to reach a conclusion. Even when a leader in the church was to be selected, what was one qualification that had to do with this?
A one-woman
man. A man of one woman. Now, somebody take that to mean married only once. I do not believe that's what it means, personally. He's a one-woman man. He's not a ladies' man. He's devoted to one woman. What about a polygamist? He better be devoted to several, huh? But he cannot, if that's the case, and they had that kind of thing back then, he cannot be a leader in God's family. So, all right, good question, Keith. But anyway,
to that point, husband of one wife. Now, if you're trying to do the extra steps, if a husband has multiple wives, he is husband of one wife. But that's the problem with using the taking extra steps beyond what's clearly authorized. It's clearly authorized to be with one wife. It doesn't say, and not of multiple additional wives. But the safe way to look at it is, it's husband of one wife and doesn't give room for the extra wives.
Okay. Husband of one wife, right. There's nothing about any additional wives. Do specifics exclude? No, but they include. And as Josh has pointed out, unless there's some other information, we have no right to proceed. Why could Jesus not serve as a high priest under the law? Do what? So what? Did the Old Testament say nobody from the tribe of Judah can serve? Specified a tribe, and as Ronnie points out, Hebrews chapter 7 says Moses spoke nothing about somebody else from another tribe serving. So if somebody besides from the tribe of Levi is going to serve as a priest, what did the Hebrew writer say must take place?
Change
the law. Because the law in place did not allow it. And just like Josh is pointing out, the law we have allows one woman for one man. We got a thought question here on applications on your lesson. How does what the Scripture teach about the purpose of the husband-wife relationship impact the following? Now, when you talk about this, this is application. We start applying biblical teaching and principles world events, there's some degree of human opinion involved in how you apply it. So I say that at the outset. So some of the things we'll say here are based upon each person's individual views. But I ask the question, what about women working outside the home in a secular job? Does that impact, or can it impact, the purpose of woman being made?
It can.
Does it mean if a woman has a job outside the home that it does?
No.
There are good godly women who are good companions to their mates. But it can in several ways. For example, let's suppose two people get married. Let's say they're a young couple. They're tight on finances. So, she works the day shift. He works the night shift. What happens? No time together. Can that impact their relationship? Yes, it can. Or, let's suppose the woman works all day and it's a very demanding job, demanding her time and her energy and all the strength she has. In the evening, when her husband's home, how may that impact the relationship? Don't have any energy to be a good companion. So get supper ready and let's go to bed. Or let me alone, I want to watch TV. It can. Doesn't have to be that way. I'm just saying it seems that it can. And then, let's say this man works for the county. He digs ditches and runs cranes and mows the grass. She has a degree. She's an executive. She makes three times as much as he does. Who is the helper? She can still be the helper if we understand what that means, right? But I mean, she's used to sitting in an office, having people wait on her, do what she tells them to do. Now she's going to go home and be submissive to this guy who came in from digging the ditch and he's all dirty and sweaty. So, we're not saying it's wrong for a woman executive to marry a fellow who works for the county. That's not our point. I'm saying is, we just keep in mind what it was from the beginning. Why did God make woman? Did he make her to help Adam take care of that garden?
No.
If there is, I found nothing in Genesis 2 about it. Did she help him? I don't doubt that she did. But that's not why she was made. Did he make her so they could propagate the earth?
No.
I have no doubt that God had that in mind, but that's not what Genesis 2 talks about. He needed something to solve his problem of being alone. That's why he made the woman. So, these are just suggestions to take these, you know, the Bible, we can study it, but if we don't apply it to our daily life and the circumstance that we find ourselves in, it will not give us the benefit that God intended. So we ask a second one here. Husbands and wives involved in political, civic, and social activities. So they're married. And later on, maybe the man wants to run for mayor, or the woman. There's women who run for mayor. What's going to happen to their time together? Their time for companionship. Even if they can be home, what's going to be happening about the phone and everything else? What's going to be on their mind? I don't know how people in a public office that's so demanding can have a good, healthy marriage. Maybe they can. I'm not smart enough for that. I don't want it. But be that as it may, just some questions. What about jobs? So, you get married. Why do you get married? Why?
You love your spouse, want to be with them forever.
Companionship. Isn't that it? It's not just so you can have a conjugal relationship. It's not just so you can have kids. Spending time together, sharing ideas and life together. So, guy takes a job, he's got to be gone 80% of the time. How does that impact the relationship?
You don't have a relationship.
Can really impact. What about if it's the woman that's got to be gone? And so, these are just things to think about. If we come back to Genesis 2, if that's important to us, and teaching your children. We've got young people here. Why are you getting married? Because it's a thing to do in America? So you can satisfy the natural desires of the body? Or is it for somebody you can have to talk to cry with, to rejoice with, to serve God with, to share ideas with. That, if I understand it, is the purpose of the husband-wife relationship. And so these comments that I'm making are based upon that. You'll have to make the specific applications. Then how does one spend his spare time? So, man works all week, he's got the weekends off. I'm going hunting. Or I'm going to work in the yard all weekend. No time to sit down and talk to his wife. Or vice versa. What happens to the relationship? Young marriage. They get married. What's one of the first things oftentimes they want to do? Have kids. So young married get married. They don't know one another very well. They've maybe dated for 6 months or a year or two, some, I don't know, whatever. But they need to have time to learn to live together. That takes some adjustment. Okay. 10 months later, they have a baby. Is that sinful?
No.
Not sinful. But, while you may want to spend time with your wife, what happens when that baby cries at night? You're going to go take care of that baby. And when that baby has a dirty diaper in the daytime. And when that baby's hungry, somebody's got to take care of the baby. And there's nothing wrong with that. I'm glad I had a mother to take care of me. And you. But marriage is not to have babies. That's a wonderful blessing of marriage. But marriage is to spend time together. So, wouldn't it be better to teach our children? Look, we want grandchildren, but more important is that you all learn to live together and love one another and spend time together and make your mate your best friend that you share your heart with, your life with. You know, if people get married simply to satisfy the sensual desires, which is a purpose of marriage, we'll study that when we get to 1 Corinthians 7. That is a reason to get married. Not the purpose of God making the woman. That is a benefit from it. But if that's it, to simply satisfy the sensual desires, what happens if unexpectedly that doesn't work out like you expected? For one reason or another. Maybe physical issues, maybe other things. What happens to the marriage? Folks, we're not talking hypothetically. I could give you examples. Obviously, I'm not. And so if the purpose of marriage is to satisfy the body's desires, you're opening the door for trouble. But even if the bodily desires can't be satisfied, if the purpose of marriage is companionship, you can have companionship without that. There'll be a part of your marriage that's missing. But you can. What if you get married because I want to be happy? Are you always going to be happy in your marriage? No, you're going to be some sad days. You're going to have some arguments. But the purpose of marriage is not just to be happy. It's to share life together, including those difficult times. And so what do you look for in a companion? So here's Wyatt and there's Danny back there. And we've got some young ladies here. And so what do you look for? The young lady said, ooh, I want a big, good-looking guy. Or the guy says, man, I want a number 10. Now, a lot of these guys look number 10 themselves. They're about a number 3. But yeah, man, I want a beautiful wife. Does that mean she's going to be a good companion? Absolutely not. That's nice. And I'm going to tell you something. If you fall in love like you ought to fall in love, I don't care what she looks like, you'll think she's pretty. We'll look more about that when we get to Jacob. So, we've got a question here on the lesson. Should all our married life, does it just quit when we first get married? After you've been married 5 years, 10 years, 50 years, are you still working to be somebody that your mate looks forward to waking up in the morning with, looks forward to you coming home in the evening, look forward to the weekends when you can be together or your time off if it's not weekends. Sharing your life together. It takes work. Remember that story in Proverbs about the garden? Guy walked by and the garden was, stones were falling down, it was all full of nettles. He didn't work on it. Marriage takes work. Cultivating, weeding, etc. You had a comment, Ronnie?
Well, honestly, this all goes back to the first sentence in your number 10. Your first allegiance after God is that spouse.
Do what now?
Your first allegiance after God is your spouse.
Right.
When Jesus is, we're quoting Genesis 2, he said that you will leave father and mother for them. And I'm not married, so it doesn't count. All these other people, they left their parents to marry this person. So that must be is more important than your parents.
Excellent observation.
It doesn't mention kids in that sentence anywhere. The sole purpose of marriage is for the two of you to be together. And that is more important than anything else other than joining the church of God.
Very good. Very good comment. And that's very important what Ronnie's talking about, to understand that our first allegiance after God ought to be our mate.
Good. Yeah,
that's going to happen.
But you can't let that get in the way of understanding that when the next, the older marriages, when the kids move home.
What about when the kids get to be 10 or 15? Can that be a problem? What? Well, I mean, can parents become so devoted to the kids it interferes with their relationship?
Yes.
There's people that devote their whole life to their kids. Finally, the kids leave home. Well, Martha, what are we going to do tonight? You know, they don't know what to do with one another. They've never developed that relationship. So Ronnie's point is well made.
Well, how many times have you heard the saying, we've got to stay together for the kids? Well, what happens when those kids leave?
Yes. Why do you have to stay together? For God's plan. That's it. It's God's plan. Listen, we got a checklist at the end of this lesson. Did you look at it? If you hadn't looked at it, look at it, please. These are questions to just try to make you think. For example, number one, do you treat your wife like a maid? Or a stepchild? A concubine? A nanny? Or do you treat her like a companion? Vice versa on the man, verse 4, how do you treat your husband? Is he just a teller machine, you know, or a cookie jar? He brings the money in. That's what's important. Or is he somebody that needs a companion? Do you share his interests, his joys, his sorrows? So look at these questions. They're just trying to make you... I wish we had time to look at number like 11, 14, 15. These will jog us into thinking about our marriages. All of this stuff we're studying won't do us any good unless we do what's at the end of this lesson. You see that bottom verse? You're blessed if you do them. That's what Jesus said about His commandments. Lord willing, next class we'll get into lesson number 5. Thank you for your participation tonight.